We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
It's the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, part of Illinois Public Media, a listener-supported broadcast service of the College of Media at Illinois. Back in the 1960s, the Beatles asked everyone to love them do, but not everyone did. Commentator Amy Guider explained some of the naysayers were high school principals and understanding judges who all liked good order to things. Here's this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
Get Back, a Miami Herald headline read just a few days ago. It's Beatlemania all over again. And that's true in a very broad sense. Remastered Beatles albums and the Beatles version of Rock Band hit store shelves this month. But 2009 Beatlemania will never reach the same level as 1960s Beatlemania. In contrast to the swooning teens forever immortalized on the Ed Sullivan Show, today's teens can indeed contain themselves over new old albums and 1960s-themed scrolling notes and lyrics. That lack of strong interest could be welcome news for some school administrators and ultimately for judges, because Beatlemania in the 1960s wasn't just a lighthearted teenage trend. It was a major headache for those in charge of maintaining good order in schools. Or perhaps I should say major hair ache. Imagine that you're a school administrator in the early 1960s. Carefully cut coifs are commonplace. Suddenly, four young men from Liverpool enter the United States and upset the order. Suddenly, kept hair is out, and shaggy hair, what some called pudding basin hair, is in. School administrators would do their best to tame those locks, even if that meant turning to the courts. Take the Dallas principal who expelled four male students who wore their hair in conformity with a so-called Beatle-type hairstyle. High school classrooms were disrupted, the principal maintained, when one student's hair fell, and I'm quoting here, over his ears and over his forehead and down to his eyebrows. One can only imagine the disruption. The principal found a friend in the federal courts. To keep these long-haired young men out of school, an appellate court decided, was a good thing because it helped maintain order and discipline. The boys with long hair, after all, were the objects of teasing and obscene language, some from a group of boys known timelessly as the football guys. Moreover, male students with long hair did not eat lunch with fellow boys, the court noted, and dined instead only with the girls. Short hair, therefore, kept things the way they should be. It's true that not every court agreed with every principal in a Beatles haircut case. A dissenting judge in the Dallas case suggested that the principal work instead to maintain order in a way that punished the football guys and not the Beatles. Another court found a constitutional deficiency in a dress code that gave the principal virtual barbering rights over student expression. But that judge felt so radical that he handed down three supplemental opinions explaining his reasons for siding with the trendy teens. Ultimately, what these cases help teach us is that judges often aren't the best arbiters of fashion or social trends. And here's the best example of that, one that came nearly 50 years before today's Beatlemania headlines. A federal judge in New York who stuffily predicted in 1964 that what he called the Beatle aberration would be limited, temporary, and ephemeral. 45 years later, the schools have survived not only Beatles hair, but ripped jeans, tattoos, and nose rings. Sometimes it seems the best course is simply to let it be. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. It's 12 minutes before 3 o'clock. Primetime television gets a major jolt tonight when Jay Leno's show debuts at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 9 o'clock Central. It's one of the most anticipated TV events of the year and the source of lots of speculation on how the longtime Tonight Show host will do in this earlier time slot. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, it's also a big gamble for NBC.
Just listen to the Hollywood chatter. A radical move, unprecedented. possibly a watershed moment in primetime programming. In the TV industry, Jay Leno's big move is by far the most talked about event, and NBC, which is in last place in the ratings, is promoting it everywhere. Billboards, bus shelters, popcorn bags, TV, the web.
Radio call at 1 a.m. that said, Grandma's drunk and ready to fight.
The Jay Leno Show, new comedy at 10, 9 central.
The Jay Leno Show promises to be a mix of new segments and old favorites from The Tonight Show, like The Monologue.
They showed a doctor on the news last night. He said, these women show no remorse. Well, of course not. They're full of Botox.
And Leno's popular street interviews in the segment Jaywalking.
Can you name two of the founding fathers?
Founding fathers of what?
NBC is moving Jay Leno to primetime in part to save money. Those scripted dramas that dominate the 10 o'clock hour are really expensive. NBC can produce 5 hours of Jay Leno for what it would cost for 1 hour of drama. But what about those loyal late-night fans? Will they want Jay Leno earlier?
America loves him, and he's a hard worker.
Scott Carter is executive producer of HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher.
I think for a lot of particularly perhaps older viewers, of which I am quickly becoming one, to get Jay Leno an hour and a half earlier each night is a good thing, not a bad thing.
But Scott Carter agrees there will be challenges.
They have to do 5 shows a week for 40 or 42 or 44 weeks a year, eats up a lot of guests.
The competition to get those celebrity guests was war between Jay Leno and David Letterman. Now add Conan O'Brien, who replaced Leno on The Tonight Show, to the mix. NBC just upped the competition for the A-listers. Jay Leno at 10 o'clock also means it'll come on just before the local news.
Live local breaking news at 11.
I think the hardest part for me is knowing that he was murdered.
Preceding the news could prove tricky for Leno and his comedy writers. Sherry Ann Brill is Senior Vice President of Audience Analysis for the advertising agency Kara.
You could have, you know, this great funny joke and the viewers are laughing, and then all of a sudden the news comes on and it's, you know, 20 people dead from gunshot fire.
Sherry Ann Brill is also skeptical that the new Jay Leno show can get higher ratings than popular dramas like CSI Miami.
Ron deserves
You're
to
not
die.
You're not answering my question. Did you threaten his life?
The 10 p.m. block of dramas is a formula so entrenched on the broadcast networks, the arrival of a comedian like Jay Leno will be a shock to the system. But NBC is desperate because they're in last place. Sherry Ann Brill thinks it's good they're taking a risk, but
it certainly won't outperform the competition on the other networks. But I think it will do well enough for it. You know, NBC to make money.
But Jay Leno has faced stiff competition before. Scott Carter says, remember his battle to beat David Letterman?
Dave was doing much better for a long time, and then Jay just kept making adjustments. He lengthened the monologue, he changed the set. He just kept tinkering with it until he became the clear ratings winner.
Nobody really knows how completely changing the menu on prime time will work, but Jay Leno is planning one heck of a launch. The first week, guests include Jerry Seinfeld, Kanye West, Tom Cruise, Halle Berry, and Miley Cyrus. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Jay Leno's move to prime time has one group in Hollywood feeling more than a little anxious. Here's screenwriter and NPR commentator John Ridley.
If you're dreaming about becoming a high-priced Hollywood writer, you might want to dream on. The Writers Guild of America West, that's the union that represents the bulk of movie and TV writers, recently released their annual report. It reads more like the script of a horror movie, and a low-budget one at that. So let me just cut to the chase. With fewer and fewer movies finding their way to the box office and more reality shows on TV, writers are suffering a near 50% unemployment rate, and year to year, earnings are down almost 20%. That's the lowest level for both in 5 years. Now, how's that for a dream factory? Living in a company town, the wretched stink of the engine of creation grinding to a halt is everywhere. I know in my travels, movie lots, once full of energy, are now populated by scribes who schlep around their intellectual property, Willy Loman style, hoping for the sale, that one sale that'll put them back on top. And if things are bad for writers now, they're only going to get worse. Jay Leno and NBC are taking a lot of flack for annexing 5 hours of real estate previously devoted to some of the best scripted television in the history of television. And, yeah, cable TV has helped breach the gap as the new destination for quality fare, but cable shows literally aren't half of what network programs are. The writing staffs tend to be half the size of network shows, the pay half as much, and the seasons run about half as long. All that adds up to three times the hurt for writers. And what does this mean for viewers? Well, not a whole lot, if you're into The Biggest Loser or movies based on comic books, but if you liked everything from Hill Street Blues to ER to Network to The English Patient, expect to see a lot less entertainment that's reliant on the strength of the written word. A Hollywood script has long been the holy grail for writers. Some of the most gifted scribes, from literature to stage, were lured west with the enticement of celebrity and pixie dust. Raymond Chandler, Graham Greene, Norman Mailer, David Mamet. Masters all, but all still seeking to master one of the most difficult feats of amusement, the delicate balance of all the elements necessary to make filmed entertainment. Way back in 1926, Citizen Kane screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz seduced playwright and novelist Ben Heck to Hollywood with a telegram which read, "Millions are to be grabbed out here, and your only competition is idiots." Well, there aren't millions to be made anymore. And the competition now is anything, and it doesn't necessarily have to be well written.
That's screenwriter and NPR commentator John Ridley. Federal and state governments have cut back on monitoring some big sources of pollution, and small sources are rarely monitored. Lester Graham from the Environment Report tells us it's now a problem that's even tougher when state budgets are being cut.
Industry does not pollute like it did in the 1960s or 70s. Today, regulators monitor most of the big factories. Tom Lyon is the director of the Urb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan.
Big smokestack industries we have a fairly good eye on, but there are a lot of areas that we still don't have a good handle on.
Like small businesses, which collectively can release a lot of toxins, and farms that use pesticides and fertilizers on millions of acres. Jennifer Sass is a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She says under the Bush administration, pollution monitoring of big industry was cut back. Sass says that monitoring needs to be restored and expanded to smaller sources.
If we quit our monitoring programs, then we don't really know. It's a lot like putting our head in the sand.
But many state agencies say they don't have the resources to keep track of all those sources of pollution. For the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Merce Cunningham Dance Company, Nearly 90, September 25th. More information on this event is available online at krannertcenter.com.
Earth and sky.
There's no area on Earth that is immune from the effect of carbon dioxide.
You're listening to Moose Shaheen, senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. He's talking about research using an instrument called the Atmospheric Infrared Sounder, AIRS, that works aboard NASA's Aqua satellite. AIRS tracks carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas known to be causing global warming.
We can look at the carbon dioxide emitted from Asia, moving across the Pacific to North America, where we add more carbon dioxide to it, and then it moves across the Atlantic to Europe. We see it going around and around.
Shaheen said AIRS also tracks water vapor, which he called the planet's most potent greenhouse gas. He said warming global temperatures mean more evaporation from the oceans. This water vapor gets stored in Earth's upper atmosphere, heating up the Earth even more.
If the carbon dioxide is causing a global warming, say, of 1 degree, the resulting water vapor in the atmosphere